It's Saturday, around noon, and Malcolm Eric Hassel is tending bar at SBC. Malcolm is groggy. Last night there was a show at SBC. This morning there's people skating and coming in and out. About half the room is occupied by this wooden ramp that Malcolm and Andrew Turner, the other co-owner of the bar, built themselves. In its current form, it's a punk venue and a bar that sells cheap banana bread and greasy snacks. I've come to investigate a rumor that I heard a few months ago. The rumor says that there's a network of tunnels that runs underneath the neighborhood, and that the tunnel network connects with SBC. The rumor also says that the tunnels have been around for a long time, maybe 100 years or more. The rumor says the tunnels connect with SBC's basement, and that some dark, maybe even supernatural stuff has gone on down there over the course of their history. Here's Malcolm again. Word of warning, parts of Malcolm's audio here is very, very bad quality, mainly because of the loud hair metal music in the back. It was a bar after all.
Do you have any sense of where they went? Did they went towards the port, or they?
We've been told to go as far as Stanley Park, like that they're all connected.
Oh, wow, unreal.
There are a lot of stories about these tunnels. Deals gone wrong, stuff smuggled in from the port, ghost stories, underground clubhouses and secret passageways to brothels. I heard a story of a priest that came down to the tunnels to do an exorcism and then had a section of it boarded up completely. Here's Malcolm again. A word of warning, parts of Malcolm's audio here is very, very bad quality.
When you guys got the place, it was like, was there anything told you about it, or like, was it just?
We were told it was used for, like, they used to, like, back in the day, it was an opium den.
Okay.
When they used to use it, when they get raided, too, to go, like, to get out, you know what I mean? There'd be a hatch. If they got raided, people would go and they'd run, they'd pop up elsewhere.
The entrance to the tunnels is in the bar's basement. SBC is named after the original bar in the same building, the Smiling Buddha Cabaret, that opened in the 50s.
We found like some old glass, like opium bottles. We wanted to even just drill a hole, you know what I mean? And put a pinhole camera, or like one of those little tank cameras with the light, just to even see how long it is. Is there shit in the way? Is there stuff on the ground?
SBC has had many different lives over the years. The building is nestled right on the edge between Chinatown and the downtown east side. And history matters in a place like this, especially Chinatown, because gentrification here depends on ideas about what history should look like. Chinatown is in the middle of a massive redevelopment effort, and it's been going on for a few years. Most of the time, it's the city planners who control what historic Chinatown looks like and what parts of history should be remembered. There are fancy red lampposts and decorative dragons that were installed a few years ago, and that's probably the best indication of the city's vision. Condos have been shooting up like weeds in Chinatown, so have fancy retail storefronts. Like the city planners, real estate developers go for a very vague history of Chinatown, or no history at all. When I first heard about the tunnels, it felt immediately like there was something to the story, because the tunnels aren't so easily mashed in with how the city and how developers want the neighborhood to look. SBC is just one of the places where the tunnels connect. They're not at the forefront of the fight against gentrification or anything, they're just a bar. But they haven't cashed in and turned into a fancy cocktail place or anything. They have their own weird, kind of gritty backstory that comes with the building.
It was kind of like a dine and dance. You know, you could bring your own bottle, it was sort of like a speakeasy, you kind of had to hide it under the table.
That was in the 1950s, when a big red and green neon sign of a smiling Buddha used to hang outside the entrance. It was opened by Harvey Lowe, a world yo-yo champion and local radio broadcaster who had become a prominent figure in Vancouver's Chinese business community.
Well, yeah, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jefferson Airplane.
Right here, what?
Yeah. Jimmy's uncle used to be in the house band here. His story is when his uncle got too drunk, like Jimmy would be here and put on his uncle's blazer and hat and then play for him. And then they eventually kicked him out for being too loud.
And then in the late 70s and early 80s, it was a major part of Vancouver's punk scene, hosting bands like the Subhumans, DOA, Art Bergman, and the Dishrags.
Like, neighborhood people come here and tell stories about being in here, it being like crazy violent. The punks took over, like 78 to 83.
Malcolm and Andrew reopened SBC 3 years ago. And before it was a bar with a half pipe, it'd been sitting empty for nearly two decades.
But even the old owner threatened to kill us. Like, literally uttering death threats. We had to go to court. It got thrown out. And we didn't, the crown...
Malcolm tells me that it had been a drug den in the mid-90s, and then fallen into disrepair. Over its lifetime, the building has had a huge part in Vancouver's nightlife history. SBC has managed to reinvent itself, but also to preserve that history in the process. Which is cool, because as the neighborhood gets primed for gentrification, Chinatown's history often gets forgotten about.
Like, we don't know what's down there. It could be, you know what I mean? Like something, it could be dead body, it could be whatever. Not that there is, but like, them were down for business.
I wanted to find out more about Chinatown, so I met Vincent Tao, the librarian at the Chinatown Art Space 221A.
It's in crisis right now. It's sort of depressing to walk around the streets because, of the looming condo towers and knowing that essentially people's lives are just going to be, like, they're going to be evicted very soon. So
we go to Chinatown Plaza for lunch. I have shrimp with egg sauce.
There's Chinatown Plaza. This is a city-owned mall. Yeah, it's sort of utopic in the sense that it seems to be peacefully, economically stagnant. Right.
The neighborhood was formed in 1886, when Chinese laborers, a lot of them ex-railroad workers, settled in the area. This was about a year after the Canadian government had put in place a head tax specifically targeting Asian immigrants. In 1907, an anti-Asian race riot broke out. There's been other flashpoints of racism in the neighborhood's history as well. But despite this, Chinatown turned into a vibrant working-class community with some of the city's most popular restaurant and nightlife spots.
It's a pretty embattled terrain, Chinatown, especially like, because it's easy to just sort of understand it as like gentrifiers and the old people. But there's like a lot of different interests sort of vying for control of what Chinatown is going to look like.
Vincent does a lot of work with Chinatown seniors, tracking gentrification in the neighborhood and its effects on Chinatown's most vulnerable residents.
There's like all these different nonprofits trying to fight to preserve Chinese heritage. Then there's Chinese business owners who are trying to sort of like eke out their share of the market in Chinatown. And then there's like, new sort of investors, like the condo developments and all these new retail stores. And then meanwhile, there's the residents, many of whom are like, low income, low cash. Chinese seniors and non-Chinese seniors, just like people in general. My work with Chinatown Action Group, we've been trying to sort of map out the different strands of power that are running through Chinatown, and then trying to find sort of strategic alliances with different people. Well, it turns out everyone's an asshole, just in a different way. Because like you talk to the Chinese business owners and they're like, we don't like poor people, but we like Chinese people and we want Chinese business, but we feel bad about this new money coming in, but we need to welcome it in order to revitalize Chinatown. And then so there's a tension between preserving heritage but also like economic revitalization. And what does not come in that tension is like, are the concerns of the people actually living there, right?
The current revitalization efforts, rezoning and new developments, comes on the heels of rising rent rates and Chinatown's newfound reputation as a kind of trendy artist hangout. I asked Vincent about how people relate to the history of the neighborhood.
The use of history of Chinatown, the sort of like imagined history of its sort of ethnocentric sort of development, is presently transforming Chinatown into some sort of like ethno theme park, right? And that's where history is a strange terrain. And as someone working with Chinatown Action Group and Chinatown Concern Group, although the history and the memories of the seniors is something very important to how we like think through our struggle, it's like also not the thing that we want to be reproduced, right? Because there are a lot of hard times in Chinatown. A lot of like terrible living and labor conditions in Chinatown that made it what it is.
So Vincent says there's an aging population of Chinese residents, plus new money flowing in as the working class neighborhood gets redeveloped. Given all this, what do the tunnels mean for the neighborhood? I ask Malcolm of the bar's mysterious basement that's connected with the network of tunnels.
So what are you guys doing with the basement now? You just have storage down there or what?
Yeah, just storage for the most part.
Can you describe it to me? What is it like down there?
Dirt floors, it's a crawl space, little ceilings.
That's me trying to casually ask Malcolm if I could see the tunnels. Eventually, he catches on to what I'm trying to do.
You feeling nimble?
I'm feeling nimble today, yeah.
You might get a little dirty. But.
So Malcolm locks the doors at SBC. He goes back behind the bar and gets a big industrial flashlight. We wait for the skaters and then walk down the center of the wooden ramp to the complete opposite end of the bar. We get up on stage, just covered in gear, and we clear it off.
Yeah, it's just, we gotta get to that.
Malcolm pushes over some stuff at the back of the stage, and then there's a panel on the floor. He unscrews it, he lowers himself in, and we both squirm down this set of wooden stairs. The basement is covered in junk. There are piles of cans everywhere, bicycles, scrap wood. There's wooden rafters right above us, and we can hear people skating on the ramp, and somehow we can still hear the hair metal upstairs as well. The floor is completely unfinished, and there's a plastic covering. And then, in a whisper, Malcolm points it out to me. It's a big, rusted steel door with no handle, no indication, no window, nothing. It's cut into the cinder block. I realize I'm looking at the entryway to what is potentially miles and miles of tunnels under Vancouver. These are tunnels that connect the city with its more complicated past. People that had to stay underground, pushed to the edges of society, lives that aren't written into the city's narrative of Chinatown. It's history that's been covered over. Even the dust down here feels like it's been watching the history of the past 100 years.
And it's facing north.
Yes.
Towards the water.
Yeah.
Wow. Are there tunnels under our feet right now?
No, absolutely not.
That's John Atkins. He's a civic historian and the chair of the Chinese-Canadian Historical Society of British Columbia.
It is one of the most persistent myths found in Chinatowns across North America, and sometimes in Europe, but mostly North America. And not almost, every single tunnel reference that you can find when you go and look into it proves to be non-existent.
We're standing in front of the Chinese Cultural Center in the corner of Carroll and Pender, at the point where Chinatown began in 1886.
Occasionally, and I think that's where sometimes people think, ooh, I found the tunnel, is that you might have two businesses that were in similar things, or they might knock a pass through the wall.
But never anything like an extensive network of tunnels.
And why would anybody want to sort of continue or spread the idea of tunnels under Chinatown?
Well, I think it comes from the fact that the Chinese were, when they originally immigrated to North America, were seen as strange, somewhat exotic, and the racism of the period really pictured them as unclean, dangerous, up to no good. Moral reform leagues across North America saw them as corrupting the morals of anybody. Health inspectors here in Vancouver warned housewives not to buy vegetables from Chinese farmers because who knows how they were growing. So there was that sort of racism of the period.
John thinks the tunnels are bogus. And really, thinking back, I ended up just standing in front of a big piece of steel when I went down to SBC's basement. So maybe there's reason to be skeptical. But more than that, John actually thinks the myth of the tunnels are doing a lot of harm. Remember, anti-Asian racism has always been a looming threat in this neighborhood.
And that's where this idea of the disappearing gamblers, the disappearing whatevers, and it's always underground because we can never see it. But because we can't find it, they're secretive and everything else. And that's where a lot of the myth of this sort of tunnel system comes from, is we can't catch them doing bad stuff. We know they're doing bad stuff. We know it. We just can't find it. And that's really where your tunnel myth comes from.
Do you think that there's a link between the tunnels and gentrification in this neighborhood?
I think as development changes the neighborhood, and that is a real concern here in Chinatown, is what is Chinatown? And how do we perceive Chinatown versus the folks that live and work here? And there's a whole issue around that portrayal. Tourism authorities like to portray Chinatowns as exotic, different slices of the world in their own city. The beautification that you see around you, the red lamp standards, the dragons, all that, that's the outside perception, adding those things to Chinatown, because one city planner said in the 1980s, Chinatown wasn't Chinese enough. And so we're adding those layers to make Chinatown conform to what we think it should be. Tunnels play into that kind of myth-making of the exotic, the secretive, the edgy, we always want something to be more exciting than it actually is. And I think the tunnel myth falls into that category of trying to discover something that's more exciting than what is actually here.
When I look at this, I think what makes me most sad is the fact that the nightlife history of the neighborhood has just become another way to push out residents. And that's the trouble. How can the history of the neighborhood be conserved without buying into the same racist myths that are helping to gentrify the neighborhood today? When I originally heard about the tunnels under Chinatown, I was coming back from a show at SBC, and I was pretty big on the idea of some lost Chinatown history that was getting washed away by gentrification. I'm a white guy that doesn't live in the neighborhood, and ultimately, I just ended up telling another story about how Chinatown was edgy and exotic. It felt like being at an antique shop and looking down to see that you're holding a little porcelain decoration with a racist stereotype painted all over it. Here's Vincent again. For an activist like him, the tunnels represent what could be a really interesting way of thinking about the neighborhood.
Just to leave it as a racist myth is to miss out on what may be like a sort of strategic point to start thinking about. Essentially, how amazing it would be if there were an underground tunnel system underneath Chinatown, right?
So how can the tunnels be put towards supporting the neighborhood and its residents? Likely, it'll involve talking about how the tunnels were just another piece in the story of racism in Chinatown. Despite how extensive the network may be, the myth of the Chinatown tunnels is part of the way a lot of people imagine the neighborhood.
It's sort of like the idea of Chinatown having its own sort of, having its own logic, having its own sort of like almost autonomous relationship to the rest of the city, but also, you know, the idea that that autonomy was forged through social relations that came out of a necessity of racist policy, right? So going underground is a sort of a metaphor for when you're under attack and you need to flee and you need to plan, you go underground, right? And you make connections underground and you build your defenses. And that's how you sort of eke out an idea of autonomy.
So maybe that nightlife history is important. The late night culture, the urban legends, maybe it means that the neighborhood isn't up for grabs. The legacy of the tunnels defies the glass towers and the city's verticality. I think something can still be salvaged from the tunnels, even if we can't get in through the steel door.